Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of South Asian Studies. We are a channel with the New Books Network. And today we are talking to Michael Levien about his first book, Dispossession Without Development, Land Grabs in Neoliberal India. So this book just came out with Oxford University Press this year. And Mike is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining us here at South Asian Studies.
Thanks for having me, Madhuri.
Well, let's start right back to how you became a sociologist, and more specifically, what brought you to the politics of dispossession?
That's a good question, because there's not actually that many sociologists study dispossession. but my interest in dispossession really started before graduate school when I was volunteering with the anti-dam movement in the Narmada Valley in central India, which probably many people know about. It's one of the most famous anti-dam movements in the world that unfortunately, despite it's really energetic and committed organizing over, 2.5 decades. It's not able to stop this big dam from being built and flooding out hundreds of villages. 2004, I unfortunately witnessed a number of homes flooded out when the Indian government raised the dam height another 10 meters. After that experience and coming back to the U.S., I decided that I would pursue a PhD in sociology largely to look at these kinds of issues. And then as I returned to India over the subsequent years, a new generation of land struggles started to emerge increasingly in the plains rather than remote river valleys against things like SEZs, real estate projects, various kinds of private investment. So it seemed to be some shift in the political economy of land dispossession that had occurred. And I wanted to try to understand what that shift was. And that's kind of the inspiration for the book. What had changed from the era of large dam building to the era of, land dispossession for special economic zones and various other kinds of privatized and increasingly speculative economic investments.
And ethnographically speaking, the book follows a case study, a longitudinal case study of a village you call Rajpura in the western Indian state of Rajasthan. And unlike a lot of anti-dispossession struggles, which were increasingly successful in that decade, right? So between 2005 and 10, I would say, this SEZ actually got built, right? So what motivated your choice of a case of dispossession that actually played out?
Right. I mean, at the time, a lot of attention was focused on these very, contentious sites of so-called land wars in India, places like Nandigram and Niamgiri and Singur and so on. And I wanted to study what actually happens when people get dispossessed for these new projects, because there's a lot of debates happening about, you know, say, especially economic zones. These are necessary for India's development. They will attract foreign investment and create jobs and infrastructure and so on. That was the argument of the Indian government and sympathetic kind of modernizers. And then on the other side, there was this kind of argument that these are predatory real estate grabs and so on. And there was a little evidence to kind of intervene in those debates. And so I wanted to go not where there was a kind of ongoing land struggle, where you would just go and talk to people who are fighting these projects, as useful as that was. I wanted to do something a little different and go where a project had either kind of not faced resistance or overcome resistance and actually get built. So you can say, well, what is the, you know, political economy driving these projects? What are the consequences for people when they're dispossessed? And so I found this project in Rajasthan a little bit by chance. I was studying Hindi in Jaipur, and I found out that this large special economic zone, the Mahindra World City, had been built 25 kilometers outside of the city. And it was really the first of the new generation of SEZs of that scale to get built in North India. And so I gradually started interviewing people about it, and through you know, some serious efforts that I describe in the preface to the book, eventually made some contacts in the village and then moved there to start the village study.
And I'm assuming all our listeners know what a SEZ or a special economic zone is, but just in case folks aren't familiar with this term, I think specific to the subcontinent, will you just give a brief explanation?
I mean, there's a kind of a genealogical relationship to, you know, EPZs, which were, you know, much earlier, form through which mostly, you know, Western multinationals wanted to invest in, you know, poor countries and exploit labor with very little, you know, labor protection or regulation or taxes. And so these things started to get promoted in the 50s and 60s. But the most proximate model for India's SEZs were China's. So China, you know, Shenzhen and so on, these massive now urban agglomerations started as SEZs. And they were largely in China, though, built by the government. They were much bigger than India's. Now, when India, about 10 years into liberalization, decided it wanted to do something similar, not been able to jumpstart manufacturing the same way as China. And so it passed a special economic zone policy in 2000 and then an act in 2005. And the basic idea was to create these highly liberalized zones in which, you know, companies would not have to pay taxes or tariffs and labor regulations would be not abolished, but delegated to a kind of business-friendly administrator. But the key difference in India was that, and this was largely, I found through my research, at the lobbying of the real estate sector, India proposed building, allowing private companies to build the zones themselves. So what would happen is the government would acquire land using the eminent domain. That's the euphemistic term used in India's land acquisition. It's really coercive dispossession. The state, you know, says to farmers, you have to give your land up for these projects. We'll give you some compensation and so on. And then what happens is that a private company gets this huge amount of land and can sell half of it for export-oriented to export-oriented companies, and then save about half the land to build upscale residential and commercial real estate. And that was the real economic incentive behind for the private developers of the zones, was that they'd get their hands on these huge chunks of land and could you know, turn it over in a very hot real estate market in India in the mid-2000s. And so it was that economic logic which explained why, you know, within a few years, there was almost 600 proposed SEZs. So there'd be these little private enclaves scattered throughout the country that would be hyper-liberalized and so on. But there's two things that were surprising about how this played out for the Indian government. The first was, you know, although they were intended to promote manufacturing, they mostly got colonized by the already kind of thriving IT and IT services industry. And the second was that they unleashed these kind of widespread land wars across the country, which made them extremely contentious.
Okay, so you arrive in Rajpura and the Mahindra World City SEZ is already up and running. And Rajpura is a large 400 plus households village, extremely heterogeneous, multi-caste. How did you go about approaching the field? What were some of your methodological approaches, concerns? Because that's a large field site.
Yeah, it's daunting. It's not one of these small villages. So it would be hard to kind of know in its entirety. But obviously you can't just kind of show up and say, hi, I'm here to study the SEZ. And so it took me a while to form some kind of contact. And it was in many ways a compromised kind of contact in the sense that, you know, the person I was finally able to meet, who was a distant relative of a, you know, a graduate student at Rajasthan University who I met, serendipitously, he was originally from that village, was a, you know, real estate investor and broker, and he, agreed to take me there. It took me a while to realize that, in a sense, I entered into the village through the networks of these agrarian elites who had kind of diversified to the city and had become land brokers as this SEZ unleashed a real estate boom in surrounding villages and land prices multiplied by a factor of like 20 and 30. These were the kind of, you know, dominant caste agrarian elites who became these land brokers and turned out to be very contentious people, because they often, other farmers felt they really cheated them in selling their land cheaply. They knew that something more valuable was happening and so on. But so anyway, it was one of these people that that provided my entree into the village. And so I went, you know, on two or three trips with these guys. And of course, they only introduced me to mostly other dominant caste elites. And it was through one of them that I was able to first secure housing in the village. And this was actually the neighboring village to Rajpura. And I wound up in the home of a pretty wealthy Brahmin who had been head of the village and so on. And I accepted this larger site unseen because I needed some kind of foothold. Now, after about a month and a half of what actually turned out to be really good data, because I was able to understand, you know, how the relatively wealthy upper caste were kind of faring post SEZ, and you know, a lot of them were actually doing quite well. They were the village had all been given these compensation plots, and while a lot of poor villagers and lower caste villagers had sold these quickly and wound up without much compensation, largely to a large extent because of these brokers who kind of convinced them to do it. A lot of these upper caste landed farmers were making lots and lots of money, brokering real estate, selling off part of their land. Some of them even got contracts to work on the boundary wall, you know, and other kinds of support infrastructure around the SEZ. Some of them were selling water pumped out of the, you know, diminishing groundwater to the company and so on. So I got to see inside that, you know, how this process was playing out among the agrarian elite for a month and a half. Of course, I didn't find this sociologically satisfying. It was unrepresentative. And so I eventually, you know, just walking through a village and making contacts and acquaintances. And one was a village school teacher who put me in touch with the parents of his pupils who were Dalits, much poorer, in the main village of Rajpura. And they had an extra room in the house they built with their compensation money. And that became, so I rented a room from them, and that became my home for most of my field work. And there I got to see a very different side of the story, what had happened to the Dalit, you know, I call semi-proletariat, who, you know, had a little bit of land, not much, were still dependent on wage labor. But the land had been pretty important to their livelihoods and were now kind of coping with life without it, not eating well, not having access to milk products, the compensation running out and not finding work inside the SEZ. And so I followed those families and how they were kind of struggling to not fall into the kind of, you know, utter precarity of the fully proletarian condition, being an unskilled laborer in rural India and going from one, you know, construction site to another.
I think at one point you observe the foods that you were eating in your second host family, the Dalits, compared to the rich ghee-slathered rotis and tall tumblers of buttermilk, and thought that was a particularly acute observation of the kinds of everyday privations that,
It was really stark, yeah. And livestock is very important to these villages, and the lower caste smallholders really had to liquidate almost all of theirs, if not all of theirs. And so the absence of milk in the diet was really acutely felt. Even if it, this was the kind of paradox, was, you know, if families had concrete houses now, that was the main thing that, you know, most of the even relatively poor households got out of the process. And so the government would classify them as above poverty line now. But they didn't have steady income and their diets had deteriorated because the precarious and low paying jobs they're able to get didn't compensate for the loss of, you know, agricultural land and livestock.
You also conducted a survey in three villages, but you also went into corporate offices of Mahindrawal City, but then also Jaipur and Gurgaon. And so you effectively studied up as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about doing both in a sense?
Sure. And that's what I started with. And even before I was able to make a contact in the village, and it turned out to be fairly easy to get those interviews. And I think, you know, I think certainly there was some privilege of being a foreigner and being American that gave me access to some of those elites fairly easily. And also in part because they didn't, they assumed I was pretty politically naive about the issue. And were quite frank with me about the, you know, the profit model in the SEZ, what needed, you know, government officials about what needed to be done to, you know, attract investors, which was, you know, acquire land and give it to, you know, private companies quite cheaply and so on. So I did get some pretty good data on that. Now, as my, you know, for the, in terms of the SEZ developers, the companies inside the Mahindrawal City, my access did dry up as my fieldwork progressed. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but I suspect it was because they saw I was studying, I was in the village, right? So at the inauguration of self-help group, corporate social responsibility projects, they would see me in the audience with the security guards and things like that. And I think they eventually suspected that it might be at least a study that might be told more from the vantage point of dispossessed villagers. But at any rate, at some point, my access did dry up with them. And so, you know, if you're dealing with the same site, it is hard to, you know, keep both of those
sides
going.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I also, of course, wanted to situate my, you know, this SEZ, my case within the larger case, you know, universe of SEZs and what difference, you know, to what extent different states were doing things differently in terms of dispossessing farmers. So I wound up doing interviews in seven states and in Delhi, which kind of is the information that, you know, is chapter two and chapter nine, really are built on those kinds of more all India type observations.
So yeah, I'd, you know, like to perhaps go back more in depth to the book. And, you know, very early on, you point out that land dispossession has been ubiquitous since the 15th century, right, across the world. And more specifically, it has been integral to the rise and consolidation of capitalism. But this interest in, you know, quote unquote, the land wars or land grabbing is relatively new, both in the popular media as well as, you know, within academia. So how can we, you know, account for perhaps this disjuncture, or rather, how would you contextualize your research against this trend, this efflorescence of interest in land grabbing now, even though it's something that, you know, has accompanied human history for a very long time?
Right. It's a good question. You know, land dispossession, of course, is a very old phenomenon. Even if we're just, you know, talking about already consolidated states dispossessing their own populations, you know, there's work that shows even before eminent domain was established in Europe, you had, you know, knights taking land for castles and so on. And of course, a lot of the debates, the scholarly debates around dispossession were about the original transition to capitalism in England, you know, what Marx called primitive accumulation. So there's a large literature around primitive accumulation, which is basically about the transition from a pre-capitalist to capitalist society. And of course, the question that Marx doesn't really address is, what does this mean outside of England? And, you know, Marx actually never really paid much attention to the economic forces driving dispossession. He was more interested in, you know, how dispossessed peasants, you know, furnish the supply of landless proletarians that was a necessary precondition for capitalism. So Marx left this kind of, you know, post hoc, a bit functionalist account of the transition to capitalism in England. But how do we think about the relationship, the ongoing relationship between land dispossession and capitalism? There was less to go on there. And that was, you know, one thing I think Luxembourg tried to get at, Karl Polanyi tried to get at, and then David Harvey really kind of updated with his theory of accumulation by dispossession, which I kind of critically engage in the book. And I think the real usefulness of that concept was to make clear that land dispossession is something that, you know, is ongoing under capitalism. It's not a kind of just a, you know, a transitional phase or something like that. But, you know, I mean, Harvey has a high level of abstraction. He groups together land dispossession with lots of other things that frankly don't seem related. And, you know, the interesting question, I mean, he underplays the role of the state, which, you know, is almost always deeply involved in land and land dispossession specifically. And then, of course, the question is, you know, how does land dispossession vary over time, over phases of capitalism and so on, and across countries today? You see very different drivers of dispossession if you look at, you know, India and compare it to, say, some countries in Southern Africa or Latin America. They have different sectoral compositions of growth. The character of, you know, the political economy, even as they all adopt kind of neoliberal policies, still looks a bit different. They, you know, so this is kind of what led me to advance the idea of regimes of dispossession as a kind of lens for thinking about, you know, the way in which land dispossession, as something that's typically orchestrated by the state, varies over time and over place, and gives us, you know, a bit more to go on to start really thinking comparatively about land dispossession. because you can't really periodize it globally. It's very clear that, you know, this is not about, you know, when the state grabs land for, you know, a free trade zone. So, you know, private real estate capital can arbitrage on the value of dispossessed land for farmers. I mean, this has nothing to do with a transition to capitalism, right? This is about, enabling private speculation and a kind of global economy and so on. So this is why I think that the notion of primitive accumulation as applied to contemporary land grabs is pretty misplaced. There's been this recent boom of empirical work on land dispossession in India and also, you know, globally. A lot of it was centered around the farmland rush. So transnational investors picking up huge amounts of land across particularly Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the way that was a response to, you know, financial crisis, to, you know, food price inflation and changes in global food economy and so on. So that's gotten a lot of attention. But then, you know, there's this larger also history of scholarship, which is particularly rich in India on, land dispossession. It was often called development-induced displacement, you know, for dams and other kinds of projects. So it's exciting new work being done. And the one thing I would say about it is that the work could be more in dialogue with each other and kind of understand, you know, why does land dispossession look different in India or China or different parts of India and so on? And, you know, how does that impact the, you know, the emergence of anti-dispossession movements, what their specific politics is and their goals and why they're successful or not, is kind of a wide open area of research for, I think, young scholars. And so I was hoping with this book to kind of contribute to that research program.
I mean, yeah, you know, the very title of your book, I think, encapsulates the argument that you keep coming back to over and over again, which is that dispossession, you know, by itself doesn't guarantee any development, be it the modernist hubris, which says that, you know, dispossession is inevitable, and the Marxist position, which, you know, envisages the dispossessed to automatically transform into revolutionary army of proletarians. And so, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about how you problematize the very notion of development itself as contained within these two regimes, and then how you set up, you know, that confrontation between the regime of dispossession on one hand and what you call the, you know, mandatory attention that we need to pay to the specificities, right, of the agrarian milieu that we are analyzing, because it's both have to be present in equal kind of nuance and depth.
Right. Yes. I mean, because this was really the main target of the book, was to critique kind of modernizing assumptions about dispossession, right, which are extremely longstanding and deeply ingrained. You know, certainly in my discipline of sociology, I think in many disciplines, is shared not just by, kind of modernization theorists, but certain variants, I would say, historically of Marxism. Whether or not it's an accurate reading of Marx is, you know, an interesting and complex debate. But certainly many Marxists have also assumed that the disappearance of the peasantry was kind of a necessary and inevitable stage in the transition of capitalism and therefore socialism, whereas kind of your straightforward modernization theorists just see that, you know, moving peasants out of agriculture and so on is necessary for economic growth. And, you know, in the context of current debates in India, that position is extremely prevalent. It's in, you know, the newspapers, it's being made by, you know, politicians, by economists, and government officials. And what I wanted to do is really push back against that argument. And I want to say, look, land dispossession, first and foremost, is just redistribution. You're taking land from one group of people and giving it to another. Now, under capitalism, it's typically an upward redistribution. And so, of course, you know, one question is, so do they really, is it really an argument that, you know, the so-called less, you know, productive people should always relinquish their, you know, means of production to those who can put them to higher and best use? I mean, if so, that's an argument, it's a normative argument, not an analytical one, for the kind of upward redistribution of wealth. But then it also struck me there's a huge empirical problem here, right? I mean, which is, you know, when you dispossess land for different purposes, different contexts, can have different, you know, outcomes. And instead of just subsuming that into this kind of latent term development, let's try to understand the different trajectories of capitalism that are being facilitated by dispossession in different times and places, and what that means, both in terms of, you know, what kind of economic growth is generated, but also the distribution of that growth. And so what I wanted to argue is that not that, you know, under India's post-independence developmentalist period, the so-called developmentalist period, that land was not necessarily, you know, dispossession was not serving development in some kind of normative sense. It was deeply impoverishing. You know, I started by discussing the Narmada Valley. I mean, what happened to the people dispossessed for large dams in India was horrific. They got terrible compensation. They were almost always impoverished and very rarely shared in the kind of benefits of whatever project was being, you know, put on their land. It was just a different phase of capitalism. It was one in which the state, you know, prioritized industry over speculation. It's one where the public sector typically managed the projects that were built on dispossessed land. There were certain kinds of not always effective, you know, commitments to labor intensity and balanced regional development. And, you know, it was still no golden age of dispossession, but it was different. Right. And with the transition to neoliberalism in India since the 1990s, what I try to track in the second chapter of the book on the genesis of the land broker state is how state governments now become basically land agents for private real estate capital. So, you know, dispossessing land for anything that represents growth, right, becomes, you know, they're willing to do that for anything. Doesn't matter if it's going to create jobs, doesn't matter if it'll provide, you know, if the infrastructure will be in a private enclave that only, you know, corporations and wealthy people can enjoy, as long as it's a higher value land use than agriculture, it's a public purpose in its development. And so what I try to show in the book is really how exclusionary this particular phase of capitalism is, and what the results are when you dispossess, you know, farmers for it, and to just really problematize this narrative. And, you know, what I want to say is that whether dispossession is ever developmental, the beneficiaries of this type of growth driving contemporary land grabs in India, it's increasingly speculative. It's increasingly non-labor intensive, and it's increasingly enclaved. And all these things come together to create an outcome like what I observed in Rajpura, where there's very little benefits to these villages, except for dramatic real estate speculation. And, you know, the problem with real estate speculation as a driver of broad-based growth is that the land is distributed very unequally, pretty much everywhere, due to the kind of failures of land reform in the post-independence period, and not to mention almost entirely, controlled by men. And so, what I think the most detailed ethnographic chapter of this book is really trying to show how real estate speculation interacts with these pre-existing agrarian inequalities of class and caste and gender to produce this, magnification of really old inequalities, making some farmers, the agrarian elite, very rich, some fraction of them, but impoverishing a larger number of them. And so, you know, basically the argument of dispossession without development is kind of this. I mean, this is the political economy of contemporary capitalism in India is one that's very exclusionary, that has few benefits to farmers, and that this is, I think, one of the reasons why it's so explosive, is that even in even small, you know, small quantities of rain-fed land can seem highly valuable in a context of growth that is not absorbing the labor of dispossessed peasants and that has very little to offer them. And I think that's, you know, a key structural underpinning of the widespread land wars that you see in India today. And it's why you see, you know, the Indian government in response is not offering jobs. It's not offering, you know, some inclusion. It's basically trying to offer them a share of the real estate rents that these projects generate. And it's not actually willing to even offer that much. The ostensibly pro-farmer policy that was implemented by the last Congress government was, you know, the BJP government has since tried to dilute it. It received pushback and had to step back. And then now it's trying to basically undercut, you know, a law that tried to at least moderately raise compensation across the country. And so what I try to argue is that this kind of underlying, you know, until India's growth model becomes more inclusive, you're not going to see these kinds of land wars go away. And even attempts to kind of buy off farmers are unlikely to really succeed in undermining these land struggles.
Yes, the chapter where you outline the, you know, the differential participation of the elites and then the semi-proletarianized and then, you know, the absolutely proletarianized and how they're all participating in the real estate speculation bubble. I mean, that just read like a Bollywood film script. It was crazy. I mean, especially how some of the figures that you were describing were six-figure dollar sums. And I mean, of course, that kind of financial speculation over a decade is going to socially transform a landscape indelibly. And I guess what, you know, I kept thinking about, because I do work on a, well, not exactly similar, but, you know, an anti-dispossession struggle, but, you know, with a very different social landscape. And, you know, in Rajpura, we see that what comes up, you know, in their neighborhood is an elite enclave with a knowledge economy where they just realistically cannot participate in a sustainable way. And that certainly does not, you know, compare to the kind of support that they, you know, could glean from their livestock, their means of production. And so, and in my case, you know, the interlocutors are far less capable of ever participating in development of this nature. And so I wanted to ask you if, you know, some of your neo-rentier protagonists who did come off ahead in some sense, I mean, how are they thinking of future generations participating in this quote-unquote development trajectory? Because I think in the conclusion, which, you know, you end in a very somber note, you know, you pretty much say that the only thing that would make farmers quiescent is rising land prices, because we certainly don't see anytime soon a change in India's economic model, and people aren't overnight going to be able to participate in, you know, BPO industries. So what is the game plan for people who are doing somewhat okay in that they have the social capital to have come off better than others? But again, as you point out, it's relative, not absolute. How are they thinking of the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I should start by saying that, you know, in addition to criticizing modernization theorists, and certain variants of stagist Marxism. My third target was really those who kind of romanticize villages, right, as being you know, these kind of harmonious peasants, commoners, and so
egalitarian, right?
Yeah, you know, and if you have just any passing knowledge of the agrarian structure across most of South Asia, you realize that's kind of ridiculous. But you know, you have steep inequalities everywhere. They do vary a lot, you know, across regions and even across villages within regions. Now, the region I studied specifically is obviously very different from you know, where you studied in Orissa. And this is very much a kind of plains peasant milieu, and it's in Rajasthan, where you had a princely state until India's independence, where you had, you know, an agrarian structure that, you know, it's not much of a stretch to call it feudal. You had lords, the Rajput jagirdars, that controlled all of the land and owned the villages and extracted corvée labor and so on. And underneath them, you had relatively well-off fractions of Brahmins and Jats who came out of the land reform process in the 50s with most of the land. And so, you know, what the village I studied was still very much, these historic inequalities were still very much, you know, present in the kind of structuring principle of village life. You had a, you know, absentee landlord Rajput family that controlled a huge amount of land that was, you know, something like, you know, 100 times the size of the average landholding in the village. And the, you know, the scion of that family had been educated at elite schools, was a, you know, investment banker at Citigroup in Mumbai. And, you know, I was just blown away by, I mean, this story, and had come back to Rajpur to be the village headman, which is a very anomalous trajectory, but it made good village, made good business sense. He could make a lot more money off his real estate in that village than as an investment banker, right? Because the land had just become so valuable after the SEZ land boom. It increased by a factor of 50, and this guy was sitting on a huge amount. And then you had all these Jats and Brahmins that, you know, had, say 100, you know, bigas of land. So that would be something like, you know, 25 hectares. You know, that they were pretty well off when it was, you know, basically livestock, single, you know, rain fed agricultural economy. And they had all diversified into, you know, small businesses and, you know, jobs in the city and so on. Many of them had kids doing that, or they had done that. And, you know, were milk middlemen and so on. And so what I show is that, you know, that group really did well. You know, they became brokers, they did well selling their land, and they made, yeah, like some of them millions of dollars. I mean, dollar millionaires. It was shocking. A lot of them were reinvesting. So the future for them is not in work, really. I mean, their kids were all also complaining about, you know, the fact that they also couldn't get jobs in the SEZ. There's still, you know, not much work to be had. And even though many of them had BAs from, you know, institutions around Jaipur, those were not sufficient even to get work in the, you know, Infosys and Deutsche Bank and the big, you know, IT companies. So they all complained about that, but they, you know, so their investment strategies were land, you know, more land, mostly for real estate purposes. They might be an absentee landlord for sharecroppers in the interim, but they're buying land, you know, near highways or near, you know, outside of cities and towns where it would appreciate. They were going, buying businesses, they were buying water pumps, they were, you know, small shops and things like that. So almost entirely in the sphere of circulation and rent, nothing really productive. So that's, you know, that's where they were going, and, you know, educating their kids and trying to get jobs. So that's one thing that I think was also a challenge for them.
Yes, I think the only productive investment you noted from capital gains was a brick kiln factory, right?
Yeah.
Which, yeah. Yes, employed people, correct.
Right. And obviously a very old industry that, you know, is not very technologically involved and is built on brutal labor exploitation. But for the most part, that was only one case. For the most part, it was all real estate speculation and good old fashioned money lending, right? So actually, the number of money lenders had just expanded, and so in all these ways, you know, these really old inequalities were kind of being refashioned, reproduced in a kind of slightly different way. So the upper caste elite was now being brokers, ripping off, you know, poor farmers as they were selling their land. Some of them were labor contractors, so skimming off of any work that they could get. They were the shop owners, so catering to the newly commercialized needs of dispossessed farmers. And they were lending them money at, you know, steep interest rates. So these kinds of village inequalities were, you know, refashioned, certainly not undermined. And so really the book is just trying to go beyond this either modernization or romanticism kind of binary and show the collision between, you know, a pretty exclusionary trajectory of capitalism that doesn't look like, you know, industrial capitalism, and these really steep rural inequalities, and to show what happens when those things come together, which, you know, doesn't match with the histories of the West, right, around which Marx talked about and the in primitive accumulation. And we don't know exactly where it's going. And so to try to, you know, I think it's a Marxian analysis, but one that's not, tries to avoid any linear or stagist, you know, assumptions.
You went back to Rajpura after your fieldwork stint. What did you see in terms of, you know, people's sort of continuing interactions with the SEZ, but also their personal livelihood crests and troughs?
Yeah, I did the first round of field work in between 2009 and 2011, and then I subsequently visited every, you know, 1 to 2 years up until this past summer of 2017. And, you know, watching the trajectories of these different farmers from different, you know, social positions kind of go up and down, and seeing the real estate boom cool off, go back up and go down again, and kind of tracking, you know, people's lives through these kinds of, you know, these vicissitudes of global capitalism. I mean, now these individual lives of farmers are really enmeshed now with, you know, what the convulsions of global finance capital. Right. So,
yes, I think at one point you said before it was rain and now it's land prices.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
And to be more accurate, it was always rain and crop prices, but now it's land prices itself, irrespective of what crops you're producing. And so, you know, the second to last time when I went back, and it seemed like the land boom had come back. And so I almost was wondering if I needed a more optimistic conclusion for at least some of the people that still had land, you know. And then by my last trip, it had crashed again. And the big thing was that the SEZ developer had closed off the road between the village and the SEZ. those who had come out with a little bit of money, you know, either the near rentiers or the kind of middle ground I call petty asset managers, were really dependent on having a small shop or a vegetable stand or something in the village market. And what kept that market going was the traffic going through the village en route to the SEZ. And the plans for the SEZ, though, always called for closing that road, though it seemed very abstract to most people. That finally happened last year, to really devastating effect on the village. So, you know, the people who had been fully proletarianized and lost everything and came out with nothing, it didn't make a difference, except that they had to bike longer, an extra number of kilometers to get to Jaipur for work now. But those who came out with some kind of small business or asset in the village saw that really depreciate fast and dramatically. So it was a pretty somber kind of note to end my field work on.
Yes. And are you working on anything new related to this project, or is it something completely different?
I'm going in two directions. One is I'm interested in, I felt like I needed to do an in-depth village case study to understand this process. And now I want to think about it in a comparative context and to understand, you know, would a similar project in a different agrarian milieu come out differently? Why do farmers protest in some places, not others? When they do, why is in some cases they're just want compensation. In some cases, like in the area that you studied, you know, they're not even willing to bargain over compensation. What happens to caste and gender inequalities, right, when people are dispossessed? So I'm trying to think about a number of comparisons that can help, you know, illustrate, I think, the huge amount that we can kind of gain from a more comparative sociology of dispossession, instead of just all focusing on our case studies and describing what happened there. Why does it look different in different places and even cross-country? So I'm just held a conference with a colleague comparing land dispossession in India and China. And I'm working on, a paper on how the consequences for caste inequality are different, in different villages, with a graduate student at Hopkins to study a different SEZ. So that's one kind of direction I'm going in. And the other is an ethnography of land mafias, which is, would take a bit to explain, but these are groups that are neither exactly, they're grabbing land, but they're not doing it through the state's formal processes of eminent domain. And they're also not exactly just regular real estate brokers or investors. But these are kind of informal coalitions of elite investors, government officials, politicians, guys with muscle power and village brokers and police and so on that use a lot of strategies to force people off their land cheaply. So I kind of came across this phenomenon during the field work for this project, but wasn't able to really fully explore it in depth. So that's my next ethnographic project. And I'm knee deep in the comparative mafia literature at the moment.
Well, that actually sounds, very... I was going to say titillating, but that's probably not the right word. I just finished watching the entire Sopranos.
Yes, I'm on the last season.
Oh, okay. No spoilers. It gets it gets even darker than you think it is.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah. I mean, the fun part of that this project is I get to watch a lot of Bollywood films on mafias, and mostly because I think these actually groups aren't mafias in the classical sense. I think they're not protection rackets. I think they don't have a boss. They don't have, body tattoos or something like that to denote membership. These are guys like the people who, I talked about at the beginning that made my, entree into the village. Real estate guys who probably some days do above board deals. And then other days do things like, I know that this guy's in a fight with his brother. Let me buy out his brother's interest and pressure him to sell. And if he refuses, I bought off the police because I have a politician in my pocket and maybe I have some guys I can call to come by and intimidate him, things like that. Or, let me encroach on, the land next to mine, or let me, sell the same plot in my housing development to three people. Things like that. But I don't think they have, Tony Soprano's. So I think they're it's a different thing. So I don't know if they are mafia, but I think in kind of exploring that phenomenon, it's going to get me into something interesting territory about capitalism and criminality in contemporary India. And it's an alternative resolution to the problem that I leave at the end of this book, right? Which is that if there's so much, you know, farmer opposition to government land dispossession, is this a kind of alternative resolution for capital of the land question? You know, is for big companies to rely on these kinds of land aggregators using shady methods to get the land for them.
Well, we at New Books Network wish you all the best for your future project. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. Bye-bye.